Welcome to The Deep Dive. We're the show where we take a stack of incredible source material and, well, we extract the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight. We give you a shortcut to being truly well-informed. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and today we're diving into The Wall Street Journal for Saturday, August 16th, 2025. Picture this. It's Saturday morning, you've got the paper in hand, and we're ready for a really comprehensive exploration of the news, what shaped the week, what hints at what's coming next. Our mission, as always, is to sift through it all, the headlines, the detailed reporting, bring you the core insights and, you know, connect the dots.
And I'm Sam Astor. It's genuinely a pleasure to be guiding you through the Wall Street Journal today. It's quite a landscape we have to cover, isn't it? We'll be looking at everything from, you know, the intricacies of global affairs, shifting economic powers, right through to fascinating insights into American society, cutting-edge innovation, and even, you know, the nuances of human experience and culture. We'll go from high-stakes diplomatic summits all the way down to the latest fashion trends, even the quiet wisdom you find in the obituaries. We're here to help you understand why it all matters and, well, what it could mean for your world.
All right, let's kick things off with what was arguably the most anticipated geopolitical event of the week. That Trump-Putin summit. Now, on the surface, both leaders talked about ending the Ukraine conflict, right? But looking at the immediate aftermath, Sam, it really feels like Russian President Putin walked away with a significant advantage. I mean, there were no announcements of new American sanctions against Russia, and crucially, no battlefield concessions from Russia. And when you think about President Trump's campaign promise ending the war on day one, this summit certainly didn't deliver even a temporary ceasefire, let alone an end to the conflict. What's your take on how this unfolded? Did that promise even factor in here?
You know, what's truly compelling, I think, is not just the stated outcomes, but the sheer power of the optics and the symbolic wins Putin managed to rack up, really, even before the meeting officially started. Think about it. President Trump's Air Force One waited a full 30 minutes on the tarmac for Putin's plane to touch down. Then you saw that warm greeting, the applause on the red carpet as Trump shook Putin's hand. And maybe most symbolically, that highly coveted one-on-one time in the Beast, the U.S. president's armored limo. That's a setting Trump's own advisors reportedly wanted to avoid, precisely because it offers such a clear visual of, well, intimacy. And this reception, it was such a stark contrast, almost jarring compared to how Trump treated Ukrainian President Zelensky back in February 2025. Remember, he and VP J.D. Vance reportedly berated Zelensky for not showing sufficient gratitude for U.S. support. That difference in treatment, it definitely sends a clear message about the shifting power dynamics. And as you mentioned, Trump, with his background in reality TV, he's absolutely known for stage managing public events. This summit was no exception.
We saw the F-22s, a B-2 bomber, F-35 jets roaring overhead, all against that huge Alaska 2025 backdrop. Now, while this visually projected American military might, the context seemed, maybe inadvertently, to elevate Putin's standing on the global stage. Trump himself gave the meeting a 10, right? He cited how well they got along, expressed huge optimism for future talks. He even went so far as to directly advise Zelensky to make a deal, remarking pretty starkly that Russia is a very big power and they're not, referring to Ukraine.
Yeah, it's clear these high-level optics, these immediate outcomes, they have profound implications for the whole geopolitical landscape. Ultimately, this summit, it wasn't really about securing a peace deal, was it? It felt more like powerful political theater. Putin just masterfully leveraged Trump's desire for a public win into these significant symbolic gains. He effectively legitimized Russia's stance on the world stage without offering any, you know, tangible concessions. So for you, our listener, consider this. How do these interactions, the subtle messages sent through these carefully orchestrated appearances, how do they impact the broader international relations you observe? And what does making a deal truly mean for Ukraine in this incredibly complex, sort of asymmetric context? It's really about weighing that public display against the actual results and thinking about the implications for everyone involved, especially Ukraine's sovereignty.
Absolutely. And as we pivot from that political stage, we see a parallel struggle playing out on the economic front, specifically across the Atlantic. European stock markets are facing what's being called, well, nothing short of an emergency.
It's genuinely concerning, isn't it? We're seeing this significant trend where some of Europe's biggest names are actively choosing not to list locally, but heading for New York instead. You know, major players like Klarna, the Swedish buy now, pay later firm, Arm, the British chip designer, even Wise, the payments company, and Flutter Entertainment, the sports betting giant, all opting for New York. Stefan Buzna, the CEO of Euronext, the big pan-European exchange, he summed it up pretty starkly. He said, Europe doesn't want to be just a zone between America and Asia. That's a powerful statement. It really captures the deep concern over there.
Yeah, and stepping back to look at the bigger picture, The severity of this crisis for Europe's historic exchanges is, well, it's truly alarming. Take London, for instance. They basically pioneered public stock trading centuries ago, right? But its listings have fallen by a fifth in just 5 years, now down to around 1,600 companies. Its total market value, about $5 trillion, which, to put that in perspective, is just slightly more than NVIDIA's market cap alone, which is sitting around $4.4 trillion. That's staggering. European leaders are increasingly pointing to this as a key reason for their economic stagnation, the low productivity, the widening wealth gap between Europeans and Americans. Stefan Leithner, CEO of Deutsche Börse in Frankfurt, he issued a pretty dire warning. He said, the wealth creation will happen to Texas teachers and California public sector employees, not to European pensioners. And this whole situation is compounded by Europe's fears that America's financial market dominance, plus Trump's America First stance, will just further reduce Europe's strategic autonomy on the global stage. The major underlying issue, and this is crucial, is the profound lack of investment opportunities for European businesses. Startups there consistently struggle to get enough venture capital, which often leaves them little choice but to head towards Silicon Valley or New York. Even when American firms do invest in promising European startups, they often push for U.S. IPOs or a complete shift of operations to the U.S. And what's particularly striking is that the problem isn't a shortage of money in Europe. Quite the opposite, actually. EU households save more than Americans on average, but their wealth has grown by only about a third as much since 2009. Europeans collectively hold a massive $12 trillion of savings, an astonishing 70% in low-yield bank accounts. As a stark contrast to the widespread stock ownership through 401ks and things like that in the U.S. This sort of risk aversion, this aversion to investment, it has a tangible impact on stock valuations. Big companies like Total Energies, Shell, Glencore, they've reportedly considered moving their listings primarily because of these valuation gaps. The S&P 500, for example, has a forward price-to-earnings ratio of 22. London's FTSE 100 is at a comparatively meager 13, Germany's DAX at 15. That disparity creates a huge incentive for companies to look west.
So, given this really challenging environment, what have European leaders actually tried to do? How are they trying to reverse this tide? The UK, for its part, has been quite active. They've tried loosening regulations like restrictions on super voting shares, which tech founders love. They've even launched a concierge service to actively court businesses to list in London. And on the public side, they've backed ad campaigns to encourage more retail investing among everyday citizens. Julie Hoggett, the CEO of the London Stock Exchange, recently urged confidence, saying, if we keep talking ourselves down, then we shouldn't be surprised of the consequences. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, across the channel, EU has revived its, well, painstaking work of trying to knit together the capital markets of its 27 member states. It's a huge project, already a decade old, involves more than 55 regulatory proposals.
Right, and that raises the crucial question. How effective have these, well, strenuous efforts really been? Stefan Leithner, the Deutsche Börse CEO we mentioned, he was part of a group looking into these deep technical problems, like differing national bankruptcy laws across the EU. He made a powerful statement. He said, we need to make the leap from talking about technicalities to fundamental change. If this doesn't happen, it will be a major shame. It would be almost a crime on the younger generation. His words really underscore the deep-seated structural issues that, you know, simple technical fixes or even new laws alone probably can't resolve. The challenge for Europe is immense. They need to foster a more dynamic, truly integrated capital market that can genuinely compete with the powerful allure of Wall Street. So for you, our listener, think about this. How might Europe's financial struggles, its increasing reliance on U.S. markets, impact global investment opportunities, or even the broader economic landscape you interact with every day? This isn't just a European problem. Its ripple effects are global. It could influence everything from trade balances to maybe even your own retirement savings if you have international exposure.
Definitely. Now, shifting from the macroeconomic landscape, let's zoom in a bit, to a more internal organizational challenge. This one is at a major global institution, the World Economic Forum. Recent reports indicated an internal investigation into its founder, Klaus Schwab. The journal reported that, well, the good news for the forum is the investigation's findings. They concluded there were only minor expense irregularities. And crucially, no material wrongdoing found by Schwab or his wife. That was from the Swiss law firm Homburger. The board put out a statement acknowledging these minor irregularities, but said they reflected deep commitment rather than intent of misconduct. They also said they've strengthened governance and expressed regret for any mistreated employees.
Yeah, but the story here is, well, it's quite a bit more nuanced than that official statement might suggest. This probe wasn't just a routine audit, you know, it was actually launched because of whistleblower allegations. Previous reporting by the Journal had detailed serious allegations of workplace misconduct happening on Schwab's watch and questionable handling of travel and other expenses that reportedly topped $1 million. Findings that Schwab himself had, until this report came out, disputed. Plus, we know a prominent board member, Patrice Brobeck-Letmath, actually resigned. He cited a toxic work environment and the need for an amicable agreement with Schwab to resolve a personal dispute he had with the founder. And this all falls in an even earlier journal investigation, nearly a year before, which described a toxic culture, specifically for women and black employees at the forum. Allegations Schwab also disputed previously. So, what we're seeing is this ongoing schism between the forum as an institution and Klaus Schwab. He doesn't hold a formal operational role anymore, but he's clearly fighting vigorously to defend his legacy after decades running the show. It's also worth noting that apparently some board members felt the findings of this second probe were serious enough to warrant more action. They wanted to clearly show governance was being taken seriously, beyond just putting out a statement.
Yeah, it really highlights the complexities of leadership and accountability, doesn't it? Even at the highest levels of these global organizations. For you, the listener, what does this internal conflict tell you about the challenges of balancing a founder's legacy with modern governance standards, especially when you're navigating perceptions versus realities within such a high-profile institution? It's a fascinating case study in organizational dynamics.
Absolutely. Now, let's transition to a deeply sensitive and incredibly complex topic. The discussions and, well, efforts around relocating Palestinians from the Gaza Strip.
It's a hugely fraught issue. These efforts, spearheaded by Israel and the U.S., they're often framed in humanitarian terms, right? Suggesting a path for Palestinians to resettle elsewhere. But governments across Europe and the Arab world have critically viewed this as, well, fundamentally unrealistic and a potential violation of international law. President Trump's role in this discussion got its biggest airing early this year. He floated that audacious concept of the U.S. taking over Gaza, redeveloping it as a tourist destination, and then relocating many of its 2 million residents.
Yeah, expanding on that, the scope of the countries reportedly being sounded out for relocation is truly striking. We're talking about nations like Libya, South Sudan, Somaliland, Syria. The idea also put immense pressure on Egypt to resettle people in the Sinai Peninsula. That led to what were described as contentious meetings, even shouting matches between Israeli and Egyptian officials, because Egypt is extremely resistant to any such plans. White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly stated that President Trump has long advocated for creative solutions, including allowing them to resettle in a new, beautiful location while Gaza rebuilds. But she added a crucial caveat. Hamas must first agree to disarm. Interestingly, South Sudan, which recently took in a few U.S. deportees, was reportedly eager to reset ties with Washington and was at one point open to discussing accepting Palestinians. However, both South Sudan and Somaliland have since denied that any such talks actually took place. The legal and humanitarian concerns around this are just profound and widely articulated. Legal organizations, humanitarian groups, governments like Malaysia, the UN, Human Rights Watch, they've all issued stern warnings. They're saying forced relocations could be tantamount to ethnic cleansing. They raise critical questions about whether exits from Gaza would truly be voluntary, especially given the current devastating war-torn environment. And this is a crucial legal point because under the Geneva Conventions, forcible displacement is a war crime. It's only permissible in very narrow circumstances, like temporary evacuation for immediate safety or urgent military necessity. The legal bar is extremely high. And the current devastation in Gaza greatly complicates any argument for genuinely voluntary transfers. It's also important to note that Israeli officials, even before Trump's proposals, advocated for such transfers. Former Intelligence Minister Yileg Gamliel presented a plan for 1.7 million to leave. More recently, far-right officials like Avishan's Minister Smoltrich and National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir have aggressively pushed this idea. Ben-Gvir explicitly stated, "Encourage migration, encourage migration, encourage migration. The land of Israel is ours." A May survey by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research indicated that 43% of Gazan Palestinians would be willing to emigrate after the war, with young, educated men being the most likely group. That raises concerns among some about a potential brain drain that could further destabilize Palestinian society.
This is truly a challenging and deeply sensitive issue. It really highlights how intentions and international law can often clash in conflict zones. For you, listener, how do you navigate information on such deeply charged geopolitical topics? What critical thinking tools can you apply when you're presented with differing interpretations of humanitarian actions versus actions that could have potentially devastating long-term impacts? It's a complex landscape. Multiple narratives exist at the same time.
Absolutely. And on a related but distinct note from the region, we got a rare glimpse of Marwan Barghouti. He's a popular Palestinian leader currently imprisoned in Israel.
That story caught my eye, too. Israeli National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir actually released a video of an exchange with Barghouti inside the prison. Barghouti's family immediately called it threatening. Barghouti, he's in his mid-60s, reportedly has had very limited lawyer visits and has allegedly been beaten several times since late 2023.
Yet the ripple effect and the broader political implications of this confrontation are quite significant, surprisingly so. Palestinian prisoners groups, the Palestinian mission to the UN, they immediately condemned Ben-Gvir's actions, called them a threat, labeled his language abusive, racist, fascistic hate, argued it was a clear violation of international law on detainees. This incident happens against the backdrop of Netanyahu's government stepping up moves against Palestinian statehood. Finance Minister Smotrich recently announced that controversial settlement expansion near East Jerusalem, saying it finally buries the idea of a Palestinian state. And this comes despite increasing international pressure, with countries like France, the UK, Australia planning to recognize a Palestinian state by September. It's also worth remembering that Western countries have already put sanctions on Ben-Gvir and Smotrich for alleged incitement of violence against Palestinians. Ben-Gvir, seemingly unfazed by the criticism over the video, actually reposted it. He doubled down, calling Barghouti an arch-terrorist and adding, "May his name be erased." This whole episode just underscores the deep polarization and tension in the region and the current Israeli government's hardline stance against Palestinian aspirations for statehood.
It certainly reveals the intense friction points over there. For you, our listener, how do you assess the balance between national security concerns and fundamental human rights in conflict zones, especially when high-profile political figures are involved and their actions are deliberately publicized, often, you know, for political gain?
A really important question. Now let's shift to something slightly lighter, but still geopolitically intriguing. The unexpected bond that seems to have formed between Finnish President Alexander Stubb and Donald Trump.
Yes, this was quite an unusual detail, wasn't it? Described as an unexpected relationship characterized by texts and calls at odd hours, including Trump asking Stubb, "Why are you up already?" Stubb, he's 57, often described as wonkish, a strong NATO champion, speaks five languages, well known for his warnings about Russia. He even humorously describes himself as Finnish by birth, Southern by the grace of God, a nod to his time at Furman University in South Carolina.
Well, this raises a fascinating question about the potential impact of such a personal connection on broader U.S.-Russia relations, especially given Finland's historical role. Traditionally, during the Cold War, neutral Finland often served as this critical bridge between Washington and Moscow. Now, as a full NATO member, its alignment is firmly with the West. The article points out that Trump has, in recent months, notably escalated his criticism of Putin. He's aligned more closely with Europe to bolster Kyiv's defenses. He's even promised to sell Europe billions in arms for Ukraine. Now, Stubb doesn't claim direct responsibility for this shift in Trump's stance, but the article suggests it's a welcome reversal for European officials who were worried about Trump's previous rhetoric. This kind of informal, personal diplomacy, exemplified by golf games and odd-hour calls, it prompts us to ask you, the listener, does personal diplomacy, even seemingly informal stuff like casual conversations or golf games, genuinely influence foreign policy? Or are they merely symbolic gestures that don't fundamentally alter strategic directions? It's a compelling thought, especially with leaders known for their unique communication styles and personal relationships.
It certainly adds an interesting human element to high-stakes global politics. Let's now turn our attention to the U.S.-China economic relationship, specifically looking at how Trump's tariffs have impacted Chinese imports. The data shows a significant decline, right? China now accounts for only about 12% of all U.S. imports. That's a sharp drop from its peak of 22% back in 2018. Consequently, the U.S. trade deficit with China has shrunk considerably, down to approximately $280 billion from its peak of $418 billion in December 2018. The article also mentioned a 90-day tariff delay that was put in place to allow for negotiations between the two sides.
So what does this significant shift in trade patterns really mean? What are the broader economic implications for both countries? Well, the decline in Chinese imports is partly down to this phenomenon called front-loading. U.S. companies aggressively imported more goods early in the year to get ahead of the tariffs. Then they subsequently stepped on the brakes once the tariff structure became clearer. This aggressive trade policy has also directly led to a significant shift in global supply chains. Goods, once predominantly made in China, are now increasingly being produced in places like Vietnam, Indonesia, India. And this shift coincides with China's own economy, showing clear signs of slowing down, particularly in its July data. That's putting considerable pressure on Beijing to implement more stimulus measures to bolster domestic growth. According to analysis from Global Trade Alert, U.S. imports from China currently face painfully high average tariffs, around 43.5%, even after accounting for various exemptions. There's also the persistent issue of transshipped goods, Chinese products rerouted through third countries to try and avoid tariffs, and Trump has openly vowed additional penalties on those. For Beijing, the challenge is clear and pressing. They desperately need to boost domestic spending, stimulate internal demand, to maintain their economic growth as their traditional export growth slows down.
This is truly a fundamental rewiring of global supply chains. For you, our listener, consider how might these profound shifts in global trade and manufacturing affect the products you buy every day, from electronics to clothes, or the industries you follow, maybe even impacting job markets. It's a dynamic, evolving situation with widespread implications.
Absolutely. And sticking with tariffs, let's bring it closer to home and look at their domestic impact, specifically on inflation here in the U.S.
Right. Because despite Trump's tariff hikes, the initial fear of overall inflation getting really ugly hasn't materialized as broadly as some expected, has it? Barclays research suggests only about 48% of U.S. imports were actually subject to tariffs in June, largely due to a whole myriad of exemptions. Yale's Budget Lab, using a slightly different method, estimates an effective average tariff rate of 18.6% currently. That's down from 21.9% in late May. So it feels like we maybe dodged a bullet, at least for now.
Well, that's where it gets interesting, because the full tariff hit might still be coming. It might just be delayed. Barclays projects that weighted average tariffs are eventually likely to rise to around 15%. That's significantly up from the current 10% at last year's much lower 2.5%. So this suggests that much of the likely inflationary pressure from these tariffs is still kind of in the pipeline. Part of the reason for the lower impact so far is that companies have been strategically importing fewer high-duty goods from China. And as we discussed, there was that massive early year surge of imports to get ahead of the tariffs. But as those front-loaded inventories deplete, imports are likely to rise again, potentially bringing those higher prices directly into the U.S. market. Barry Roth, he imports used cars from Canada, provides a really clear example. He saw his monthly imports surge almost 1,500 cars back in January as dealers desperately tried to beat the tariffs. But now with new 25% levies in place, he says he's lucky to import 400 vehicles a month. He wisely states, it's not going to happen tomorrow, it's not going to happen next week, but it will ratchet up.
This inventory depletion means prices will inevitably rise as new tariff-affected stock enters the market. Companies, too, are becoming increasingly willing to pass these costs on to consumers now that the final rates are clearer. Randy Carr's company, World Emblem, they import uniform patches from East Asia. They initially absorbed over $1 million in tariff costs to protect customers. But they are now, finally, raising prices by 6% to 25% starting in September. As Carr put it, we just don't see the sense of waiting anymore.
This is a direct, tangible link between trade policy and your wallet. For you, the listener, how might these impending price increases affect your household budget or the cost of your favorite products in the coming months as these delayed tariff impacts begin to ripple through the economy?
It's a perfect example of how complex economic policy can have a very real personal effect. Yeah. And speaking of policy, let's turn to a significant domestic issue: the Trump administration's attempts to assert control over the D.C. Police Department.
Right. This started with a highly aggressive move by Attorney General Pam Bondi. She issued an order naming the DEA head, Terry Cole, as an emergency police commissioner for the DC Police, the MPD. But the latest update indicates a significant paring down of this move. A new order now makes Cole a liaison, not a commissioner, after a federal judge ordered a truce in the ongoing legal battle. It sounds like a significant walk back.
It absolutely is. And stepping back, this whole situation highlights a complex legal and operational battle playing out between federal and local authority. DC's lawsuit argued Bondi's initial order threatens to wreak operational havoc, creating profound confusion and directly seeking to divest control from DC and its chief, Pamela Smith. DC Attorney General Brian Schwab called the temporary truce a win for the city. Trump's rationale for the initial aggressive stance cited a rarely used 1973 federal law, the Home Rule Act, to justify needing additional forces, including 800 D.C. National Guard troops, to make the city safe. We've seen a tangible federal presence on the ground, too. Hundreds of federal agents joining foot patrols, traffic stops, even setting up checkpoints that netted dozens of immigration violations, including a vehicle checkpoint on a main thoroughfare. Chief Smith herself had reportedly loosened policies to allow D.C. officers to discuss immigration status with federal agents. And Bondi stated quite clearly on Fox News that D.C. police must give the information to our ICE, to our Homeland Security officers. The core of the dispute really lies in the differing interpretations of that 1973 Home Rule Act. D.C. officials staunchly argue it only allows a president to direct the mayor to provide police services, but not to oust the chief or unilaterally change the chain of command. In contrast, the administration claims it empowers Cole to issue direct orders, effectively taking over. Chief Smith herself, reflecting the severity of it all, declared, "I have never seen a single government action that would cause a greater threat to law and order than this dangerous directive." This raises profound questions about the balance of power.
It truly does. For our listener, what are the broader implications of federal intervention in local law enforcement for cities, for civil liberties, especially when there's such a fundamental disagreement about legal authority? How do you think about the appropriate balance of power between federal and local authorities in a context like this? It's a profound question about governance, about civil society in a modern democracy.
A critical discussion. Let's now shift to a broad societal trend. This one's less about policy, more about everyday life. Americans moving at record low rates.
Yeah, this phenomenon suggests people are increasingly stuck in place, right? With fewer entry-level jobs available, a general decline in geographic mobility, it's leading economists to worry about a lost dynamism in the country. A compelling illustration is Josue Leon. After graduating from Penn with an engineering degree, he applied for over 200 jobs since April. He's racked up credit card debt, living with his girlfriend's family. He even turned down a job offer because it required relocation and the salary just wasn't enough to justify the move. And this is all happening even though consumers are still spending. GDP growth has slowed, hiring disappointed this summer. It paints a picture of real individual struggles behind the big economic data.
This is a truly significant societal shift, and we can really break it down by looking at both the housing market and the job market. Historically, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, about 20% of Americans moved annually. That was a sign of economic fluidity. That figure has steadily declined, hitting just 7.8% in 2023-2024. That's the lowest rate since 1948. And a big part of this is a dramatic 47% decline in moves within the same county over the past three decades. So first, let's consider the housing squeeze. That's a major factor. Take the Rieke family in Summit, New Jersey. They bought their 1,100-square-foot home in 2017 with a fantastic 3.6% mortgage. The plan was to upgrade as their family of three boys grew, but now, with current higher mortgage rates, a bigger home would literally double their monthly payment. It's unaffordable. So they're staying put, despite desperately needing more space. Similarly, the Rufato family in suburban Chicago, they've lived in their 2,400-square-foot home for 35 years. They're effectively clogging the market for younger families, but they can't find a suitable alternative because so many would-be sellers are also stuck in their low-rate mortgages. The financial burden is immense. Housing costs now eat up a staggering 39% of the median income, up from 30%. As a result, home sales recently hit their lowest level in nearly 30 years. And it's not just local moves. Intermetro moves, moving between cities, have also fallen by a substantial 29% since 2021. Then there's the stagnant job market. This is a stark contrast to that immediate post-pandemic era where job applicants could seemingly name their price, had loads of options. Now, hiring, quits, layoff activity, all have fallen to their lowest level since 2009. The probability of switching jobs has significantly decreased from 2.8% in the 1990s down to 2.3% in the 2020s. A recent New York Fed survey shows employees are far less optimistic about finding new jobs quickly. An Indeed poll found that fully half of respondents are consciously sticking to their current jobs to avoid being the first laid off if cutbacks happen. This creates what Guy Berger, an economist, calls an insider-outsider divide, where it's just harder for those outside the workforce or seeking a new role to get in. The long-term impact of this immobility is severe. Underemployed recent grads, for instance, are three times more likely to remain underemployed a decade later. Think back to Josue Leon, the first-gen college student we mentioned. He expected a guaranteed job, but found it a needle in a haystack. Now he's happy to simply stay in Texas, taking what he can get. Employers, too, are seeing this decline in willingness to relocate. Kelly Services Engineering Division, for instance, saw relocation requirements drop from 10% of their positions to a mere 2-3%. The necessity of dual-income households also limits interstate mobility. Families are tied to two jobs. Craig Allen, for example, laid off from his project manager job, can't leave Columbia, Maryland, due to his wife's stable job and his daughter's high school. So he primarily seeks remote work. And Grace Ahn, 25, with a fine arts degree, makes only $22 an hour as a social worker despite applying for 20 marketing jobs a day. She laments, "At first I was so naive, so excited, I was like, the whole world is my oyster. The oyster has now expired."
That's such a powerful and frankly relatable quote. It paints a vivid picture of this profound shift in American mobility and opportunity. For you, the listener, do you feel stuck in place in any aspect of your life, whether it's your job, your home, even your community? How do these economic and social trends resonate with your own experiences or observations? It's a fundamental change affecting so many.
It truly is. Now, let's pivot to a unique intersection of law, politics, and business.
Yeah.
These pro bono deals struck between elite law firms and the Trump administration.
This was an interesting story. Nine prominent law firms collectively promised $1 billion in pro bono work on favored causes. This was after President Trump issued executive orders threatening their access to federal buildings and government contracts. But the Journal report indicates many of these firms are embracing, let's say, broad interpretations of their commitments. They're shrugging off the deals as unenforceable and consequently taking on very little new unpaid work. Kirkland & Ellis, for example, is noted for helping the administration in trade deals, which some might argue goes beyond what was spelled out in the spirit of the pro bono agreement.
Yeah, this is truly fascinating peek behind the curtain at the nature of these, well, digital napkin deals, as some call them. Trump originally announced the terms via Truth Social posts, an incredibly unconventional method for such significant agreements with major institutions. The origin of these deals stems directly from Trump's executive orders that threaten law firms' federal access, security clearances, citing their diversity practices, and what he called their connections to his political enemies. Paul Weiss was the first firm to commit, publicly pledging $40 million for veterans and fighting anti-Semitism. White House spokesman Harrison Fields stated quite dramatically that law firms that have for years propelled one-sided justice have started serving their nation. But the unenforceability aspect is absolutely crucial here. Four firms that refused these deals subsequently won court challenges against the executive orders. That significantly bolstered the belief that, you know, social media announcements just aren't legally binding contracts. The challenges of fulfillment are also glaringly apparent. Cadwallader, a smaller firm, committed a staggering $100 million. It would take them two decades to fulfill that at their current pro bono pace. And reportedly, they never even followed up on a suggestion to help the Brooklyn DA's office, indicating maybe a lack of serious intent or capacity. Justice Department lawyers, in an ABA lawsuit related to this, even noted no additional action had been taken against firms in 4 months, implying sanctions may never happen. As one retired lawyer, Gary DiBianco, put it, the administration has completely lost the leverage. Yet these deals have had a clear effect in another way. Deal-making firms have become noticeably reluctant to take on public interest litigation that challenges the administration. This has caused many nonprofits to start hiring in-house lawyers instead. On the flip side, conservative groups have reportedly inundated these firms with requests, pro bono work for January 6 riot participants, a landlord group, even a Republican donor's criminal case.
It really highlights the gray areas that emerge when informal agreements and political pressure meet formal legal and ethical obligations. For you, the listener, what does this reveal about the intersection of political pressure, legal ethics, and corporate responsibility in today's landscape? It's a complex dance with definitely blurred lines.
Indeed. Now let's turn to the stock market, where we saw the Dow Jones Industrial Average hit its first intraday high of 2025 this week.
Yes, and this surge was primarily driven by United Health Group shares. They jumped an impressive 12% after Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway disclosed a $1.6 billion position in the healthcare giant. This is particularly notable given that United Health was the Dow's biggest laggard since April. Its shares are still down 40% for the year, so it was a significant turnaround for them.
Well, stepping back, what does this specific move mean for the broader market picture? While the Dow climbed nearly 0.1% to that new intraday high, the S&P 500 actually fell 0.3%, and the tech-focused NASDAQ lost 0.4%. However, it's worth noting, the S&P and NASDAQ have already clinched 18 and 20 record closes, respectively, for 2025. So they've been on a different trajectory for much of the year. The Dow's slower climb to a new high is a consequence of its price-weighted methodology. That means stocks with higher share prices, like United Health, have a greater influence on the index's movements, even if their market cap isn't as large as, say, a tech giant. As for underlying economic indicators, well, retail sales ticked up 0.5% in July, suggesting surprisingly resilient consumer spending. Yet the University of Michigan sentiment survey showed consumers' mood soured due to rising inflation expectations. Earlier in the week, a mild CPI report had boosted hopes for a September Fed rate cut in 92% likelihood on Thursday, but then hotter-than-expected wholesale inflation data on Friday renewed doubts, dropping the likelihood to 87%. Trevor Slavin at Barings commented that economic growth is moderating. That should continue to support the idea that we're moving past the need for restrictive policy, adding he still expects the Fed to cut at least twice this year. Adding to the volatility, chip stocks broadly declined after Trump indicated he could announce tariffs on semiconductor imports next week, starting lower and rising over time. Applied Materials plummeted 14%, KLA fell 8.4%, Lam Research down 7.3%. Interestingly, Intel, a major U.S. chip maker, gained 2.9% on separate reports the Trump administration might take a direct stake in the company, a fascinating countertrend amidst the tariff news. Overseas, Hong Kong dropped about 1% on China's slowdown, and the stocks Europe 600-inch lower ahead of the Trump-Putin summit we discussed earlier.
This is a great example of seemingly contradictory market signals influencing different sectors all at once. For you, the listener, how do these mixed signals affect your perception of the overall economic outlook? And what does the talk of government intervention, whether tariffs on chip imports or a potential government stake in Intel, mean for the independence of critical economic institutions like the Fed, or even the future of U.S. industrial policy?
Precisely. Now let's look at a case highlighting regulatory oversight in the finance industry. The SEC recently penalized TZP Group, a private equity buyout firm. They were charged with charging investors excessive management fees without proper disclosure.
And the settlement includes a $175,000 penalty, plus the firm has to return approximately $509,000 in improperly collected fees and interest to investors. That's a significant chunk of change.
It is. And this case provides a window into the common 2-in-20 private equity model. That's the 2% management fee, 20% cut of profits, and specifically the practice of offsetting. Private equity firms often collect various other fees directly from their portfolio companies. These are typically supposed to be offset or deducted against the management fees charged to their investors. TZP's alleged violations specifically related to the improper calculation of these management fee offsets across 9 of their funds between 2018 and 2023. The SEC found this led to undisclosed conflicts of interest and a failure by TZP to adhere to their contracts with fund investors. Specific examples the SEC highlighted included TZP deferring fees from portfolio companies, then charging a full 8% interest on those deferred sums without disclosing this to investors or reimbursing them. They were also found to be duplicating certain fees in their calculations. Ultimately, this resulted in lower fee offsets for investors than they were actually due.
This incident underscores the ongoing scrutiny by regulators like the SEC into fee practices within private equity, aiming to ensure transparency and proper adherence to contracts, especially given the sometimes opaque nature of these structures.
It really highlights the complexities of financial regulations and the persistent need for transparency in investment firms, especially those managing substantial capital for others. For you, the listener, what does this incident tell you about the importance of digging into the fine print of financial agreements, even with seemingly reputable firms?
A good lesson for any investor. Let's now shift to a fascinating application of technology that directly addresses a growing concern. Companies investing in hyperlocal weather monitoring using tiny weather stations.
Yes, a great example of this is MasterCard. They have devices strategically placed outside their Kansas City office. They're gathering minute-by-minute data, specifically during a heat wave. It sounds almost sci-fi, but it's happening right now.
It's quite a proactive move. And stepping back, the core reason driving this trend is the increasing commonality and sheer unpredictability of extreme weather events we're seeing globally. Wildfires in L.A., floods in Europe last year, ongoing record heat waves. Broad regional weather reports, like what you get on your local forecast, just aren't enough anymore for complex business operations. Companies now need latitude and longitude-specific information. As Ellen Jakowski, MasterCard's chief sustainability officer, put it, "We need to know what the flood risk is for a building in London, not the city of London as a whole." Sarah Kavnick, formerly chief scientist at NOAA and now JP Morgan, highlighted the need for even more granular detail, like precise info on microbursts, those subtle localized columns of sinking air that can cause tornado-like damage. We're seeing real-world applications of this, too. Duke Energy, for instance, learned a critical lesson from Hurricane Helene last year. It caused significant fallout not just on the coast, but unexpectedly in western North Carolina, an area not typically hit so hard. Their experience showed the importance of localized data. Danone, the massive yogurt maker, is also investing in this hyperlocal approach. They're focusing on drought-resistant crops, advanced animal monitoring systems, even giving their dairy herds in Spain frequent showers during intense heat, all to support the dairy industry's resilience. This trend reflects an evolving and necessary corporate preoccupation with meteorological risk at their individual sites and throughout their business networks. Acknowledging that, as one expert concisely put it, we all know it floods on one side of the street and sometimes not another.
That's a great illustration of how precise information can make a real difference. For you, the listener, how might climate change impact your industry or even your daily life in unexpected ways? And how could hyperlocal data, like from these mini weather stations, potentially help you prepare and build resilience in your own context? It's a fascinating blend of technology and environmental adaptation.
It truly is. Now let's transition to an even more futuristic mode of transportation that's quickly becoming reality. Joby Aviation recently completed a significant milestone. Its first flight between two California airports, Marina and Monterey, in FAA-controlled airspace, flying alongside other aircraft.
That's a huge step. Flying with other aircraft in controlled airspace seems like a major hurdle cleared. What's the true significance of this for the dream of commercial air taxis?
This is indeed a critical moment for commercial market readiness. This achievement by Joby highlights profound advancements in safety protocols, operational capabilities, integration with air traffic control, and crucial progress towards certification for Joby's all-electric air taxis. Joby shares, perhaps unsurprisingly, rose 8.4% in pre-market trading on the news. The company is now in the final assembly phase for the aircraft it'll use for formal FAA evaluation. They plan to begin flight testing with FAA pilots early next year. They're clearly aiming for a commercial launch in major urban centers, initially planning for New York and Los Angeles. This specific flight was a 12-minute journey, 10 nautical miles. It marked the first time a piloted electric vertical takeoff and landing, or eVTO air taxi, flew from one public airport to another, successfully navigating all typical stages, from vertical takeoff to wingborne flight. Earlier this month, Joby also announced his plan to acquire Blade Air Mobility's passenger division for up to $100 to $25 million. That importantly includes Blade's existing operations, lounges, and brand in the U.S. and Europe, further solidifying Joby's position as it moves aggressively towards commercial service.
This really does feel like science fiction becoming reality. For you, the listener, how might air taxis fundamentally change urban transportation and connectivity in the future if they become widespread? And beyond the tech itself, what do you think are the remaining hurdles? Things like public acceptance, regulatory challenges, or even the necessary infrastructure build-out?
Precisely. From air taxis to artificial intelligence, let's now discuss a major investment that just happened in the AI sector. Cognition recently secured about $500 million to advance its AI code generation business, with Peter Thiel's Founders Fund leading the round.
$500 million. That's a massive vote of confidence. What does this kind of infusion mean for the future of AI code generation and the tech industry as a whole?
Well, this $500 million infusion isn't just about one company. It reflects incredibly strong investor confidence. It's driven by this profound belief that as AI models get more adept, more sophisticated at generating code, vastly more software will be written. This, in turn, is expected to fundamentally expand the entire software market itself. AI coding companies are already showing remarkably rapid revenue growth. For example, Windsurf, which Cognition recently acquired, had an annualized revenue rate of about $82 million and served over 350 enterprise customers when they bought it. Cognition itself has seen a remarkably rapid rise. Founded only in 2023, it had already raised over $300 million before this latest financing. Joe Lonsdale's 8VC led a prior round at a staggering $4 billion valuation earlier this year. This significant investment signals a profound, potentially disruptive shift in how software can be developed in the very near future.
It's truly a potential game changer for software development. For you, the listener, how might advancements in AI code generation impact the job market, especially for traditional software developers? And more broadly, how might it change your own interaction with technology and software in the years to come? It raises some very compelling questions about automation and creativity.
Absolutely. Now let's turn to the semiconductor industry and the ongoing challenges at Intel, particularly these reports that the Trump administration is potentially taking a stake in the company, which caused Intel shares to jump 2.9%.
This idea of the U.S. government taking a stake in a major tech company like Intel, it certainly raises eyebrows. Is this move towards something that sounds like nationalization, a viable long-term strategy for U.S. tech competitiveness?
That's the core question here, isn't it? Intel has been struggling significantly to regain its manufacturing lead from TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company. They've spent tens of billions over the past 3 years trying to catch up. The fundamental problem seems to be that Intel's most state-of-the-art process, called 18A, is primarily being used for its own products. That indicates few external customers have found the tech compelling enough to sign on for Intel's contract manufacturing services. Wall Street analysts even expect another $7 billion in negative free cash flow for Intel this year, a clear sign of the financial strain. CEO Pat Gelsinger has even drawn a line in the sand, stating quite publicly he won't commit major capital to Intel's next process, 14A, without clear, substantial external customer commitments. This precarious situation is all framed by profound national security concerns. Most cutting-edge chips are currently made in Taiwan, which is a growing flashpoint for U.S.-China tensions. Major U.S. companies like Apple and Nvidia, they rely heavily on these chips. A disruption in supply could cause severe economic hardship for the American economy.
Intel is uniquely positioned as the only U.S.-based company still capable of manufacturing these cutting-edge chips. However, while direct federal support might offer crucial short-term relief, stability, the article raises a critical point. It could potentially cause great harm to the U.S. tech sector in the long run by distorting market dynamics, potentially stifling competition, genuine innovation.
That's a huge strategic dilemma for the U.S. For you, the listener, how dependent are you on technologies that rely on advanced chips? And what does this geopolitical dynamic mean for the future of tech supply chains, global innovation, even the products you use every day? It highlights a delicate balance between national security and free market principles.
A truly complex interplay. Now let's go from high tech to high thrills, or perhaps the lack thereof, as we look at what's going on at Six Flags this summer.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like much fun at all over there. The picture painted for Six Flags is pretty dismal. A 9% drop in attendance, their third consecutive quarterly loss, and a host of issues including bad weather, broken rides, construction delays. We even saw those viral videos of stranded riders on the Siren's Curse roller coaster forced to descend a narrow staircase from 100 feet up. That sounds terrifying and frankly miserable.
It does indeed. So what do these challenges really signify for the theme park giant? The struggling Six Flags is the product of that roughly $2 billion all-stock merger with Cedar Fair back in late 2023. While Cedar Fair owns strong regional brands like Cedar Point and Knott's Berry Farm, Six Flags itself had developed a reputation for inconsistent operations, aging infrastructure. The merger was initially projected to yield $120 million in cost savings, promised new pricing strategies in overlapping markets. However, the operating challenges have been immense. Severe thunderstorms, excessive heat-forcing closures, new ride launches significantly delayed, Quantum Accelerator pushed to next year, King to Kai replacements now 2027. This really highlights the never-ending arms race in the theme park industry of building bigger, wilder rides, which comes with its own set of operational complexities. Fan feedback, like from Matthew Kachowski, who's ridden over 200 coasters, points to persistent operational issues, frequent breakdowns, incredible slow loading times, cleanliness issues, consistently poor in-park food options.
The company's frequent use of bad weather as an excuse is also being increasingly questioned by analysts, by fans, especially when rival United Parks and Resorts, they operate SeaWorld, Busch Gardens, saw their attendance rise during the same period. Looking ahead, Six Flags is reportedly considering strategies like selling off undeveloped land, even closing some underperforming parks to generate much-needed funds for new coaster investments and crucial debt reduction.
It sounds like they're really in a difficult spot. For you, the listener, what do these challenges at a major player like Six Flags tell us about the broader leisure and entertainment industry, especially facing climate change impacts and economic uncertainty? And how might these factors influence your own summer plans and entertainment choices, maybe pushing you towards different forms of leisure?
It highlights how even an industry based on fun has serious business challenges. Now let's explore an incredibly influential network within Silicon Valley that's been making significant waves. The Palantir Mafia.
Ah, yes. This refers to the founders of many buzzy new startups who once worked at Palantir, the data analysis firm co-founded by Peter Thiel. Palantir itself is known for its sometimes controversial work with the U.S. military and intelligence agencies, including supporting the Trump administration's immigration crackdown, as well as its commercial clients. And its stock has actually quintupled in the last 12 months, which speaks volumes about its current influence.
Yeah, the depth and reach of this network are truly fascinating. Alumni openly refer to themselves as the Palantir Mafia, speaking at venture fund events, communicating constantly through informal WhatsApp groups, Signal chats, some playfully named things like Palantir Pals. The sheer scale of their impact is impressive. Over 350 tech companies started or are now led by Palantir alumni, at least a dozen of them already valued over $1 billion. There are even specialized venture firms like Alumni VC,
specifically dedicated to investing in these alumni-sounded startups. It creates a self-reinforcing ecosystem. We have compelling examples of their influence. Take Nick Nooney. He applied Palantir's forward-deployed engineering approach, originally developed for military special ops, to his company, Paragon Technologies. He embedded with the San Pablo Police Department, directly helped them solve a complex homicide case. His company is now valued at $2.5 billion, has major federal contracts. Another alumnus, Kobe Blumenfeld-Gantz, who previously worked on agricultural and national security projects at Palantir, founded Chapter, a successful Medicare and retirement tech company. Other key figures in this powerful network include Joe Lonsdale, Gary Tan, Melody Hildebrand, all making significant impacts across various sectors. However, there's also a delicacy to this association. Shreya Murthy, founder of the popular social planning app, Partiful, for instance, faced significant social media criticism for her past work at Palantir, specifically due to its government contracts, involvement in controversial areas.
It really underscores the power of networking and shared experience within a tight-knit industry like Silicon Valley. For you, the listener, what does the rise of these mafias from powerful tech companies, be it PayPal, Google, or now Palantir, tell us about networking, funding, and the interconnectedness of Silicon Valley's innovation cycles. It's a powerful example of how a shared origin can create a self-sustaining ecosystem of innovation and capital.
A potent force shaping the tech world. Let's shift gears now to a truly unique urban endeavor, New York City's Tree Census.
This is one of my favorite quirky stories. It involves this dedicated army of volunteers fanning out across the city to count trees. We heard about Adam Hay, a self-described tree-famous counter who single-handedly tallied an impressive 3,331 trees back in 2015, known for his incredible accuracy in identification and location recording.
This civic effort is a fascinating look at how a city manages its natural environment. The census's primary purpose is to check on the health of the city's urban forest and, you know, plan for more planting. For many, it's a simple civic activity, a way to contribute. But for a handful of devotees, as the article puts it, it truly becomes an obsession. Some clear their entire summer calendars for long hours of counting. The census has evolved technologically, from clipboards and pencils in 2005 to a sophisticated GPS-enabled smartphone app today. Interestingly, this year, a car equipped with high-tech LiDAR is automating the tallying of the city's 666,000 sidewalk trees. That leaves only 157,000 park trees for volunteers. This change, while efficient, actually makes breaking past volunteer records, like Jennifer Chen's incredible 4,800-plus trees in 2015, much harder. Though she remains tree census royalty and is still recognized by Parks Chief Iris Rodriguez-Rosa. While few apple trees are found growing on city streets, common types include sturdy zelkovas, pin oaks, little-leaf lindens. The job also presents unexpected challenges, as volunteer Samuel Bishop discovered when he spotted a mangled dead pigeon during his counting duties. And despite its abundance of trees, Central Park is notably excluded from this census because its conservancy counts its own trees. Even popular spots like Union Square Park, with its surprisingly modest copse of 164 trees, draw dozens of enthusiastic volunteers, making it, as one person described, a madhouse.
That's a wonderful detail. For you, the listener, how do seemingly niche civic projects like a city tree census contribute to larger urban planning, community engagement, and environmental awareness in a major metropolis like New York? It's a powerful reminder that large-scale environmental understanding often starts with hyper-local grassroots efforts.
It certainly does. Now let's explore a particularly polarizing conversation that's been dominating health and lifestyle discussions. The debate surrounding GLP-1 weight loss drugs.
Right. In the world of fat activism, terms like overweight, obesity, even the drug name Ozempic are often deemed verboten, forbidden. The goal of this movement, as they articulate it, is to destigmatize and accommodate fatness in society, focusing on body acceptance regardless of size.
This is where we see two deeply contrasting viewpoints. From the perspective of obesity medicine, reframing obesity as a legitimate disease, which the AMA officially did back in 2013, is seen as absolutely crucial for destigmatization. Doctors in this field view GLP-1s, those glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonists, a class of groundbreaking drugs that help regulate appetite and blood sugar. They see them as breakthrough tools for addressing not only obesity, but related conditions like type 2 diabetes, heart disease. Louis Aron, a co-founder of Obesity Medicine, stated quite clearly, "We are not prosecuting people for having obesity. We look at treating obesity as central to helping with all their other health problems. It's a medical intervention for a medical condition." However, fat activism takes a much more suspicious stance, particularly regarding potential long-term side effects and the societal implications.
Marilyn Wan, a longtime fat activist, suggests a critical underlying motivation. People think that if everyone can just take this expensive, dangerous drug, we can get rid of fat people. It just creates more work for fat activists.
She argues that the widespread hype around these drugs significantly increases societal pressure to lose weight and perpetuates the harmful cycle of weight cycling, where individuals repeatedly lose and regain weight. Yet some facts are indisputable. Approximately 4 in 10 U.S. adults have a BMI over 30, classifying them as obese. Obesity is associated with significant financial costs, estimated at a staggering $385 billion in health spending in 2024 alone. Employees with obesity reportedly have 7 times the medical claims, 11 times the indemnity claims, file twice as many worker comp claims. Fat studies, an interdisciplinary academic field, specifically focuses on weight-based depression and often critiques the weight loss industry, citing cautionary tales like FenFin in the 90s. Realities of GLP-1s include that they are ineffective in 10-15% of patients, typically yield only 5-20% weight loss, and won't miraculously transform profoundly obese individuals into thin ones. It's also well documented that weight discrimination is common, often disproportionately stronger against women. However, the nuance is important. Many overweight people genuinely find the term fat shaming and genuinely desire to lose weight for their own health and well-being. Tommy Tomlinson, an author and a GLP-1 user, described the drug as transformative, stating it made food noise, that constant mental chatter about food, disappear. For him, it led to a profoundly comforting realization. It was shattering in a way, but also comforting, to be told it's not your fault. Activists like Osborne of NAFA, the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance, clarify their goal isn't to stop people from losing weight, but to create a world where people can live freely in the bodies they are in, without judgment or discrimination.
That's a powerful and empathetic way to frame it. For you, the listener, how do you balance the medical perspective on disease and treatment with social movements advocating for acceptance and destigmatization? What are your thoughts on individual choice versus broader societal pressure when it comes to health and body image? It's a complex and deeply personal debate.
A truly nuanced topic.
Yeah.
Let's turn now to a lighter but deeply human trend, the growing phenomenon of adult sleepaway camps.
I love this idea. Liv Schreiber, founder of Camp Social, created it to directly address what she calls the adult friendship gap. She argues that in a world increasingly dominated by social media, remote work, people simply lack a blueprint for building genuine friendships outside established circles.
It's quite remarkable how these camps are thriving. They've seen a genuine surge in demand. Camp Social even had to add a second session this summer. Camp No Counselors is expanding to Texas. A key shift, according to the article, is the change in attendance demographics. A striking 92% of attendees at Camp Social now come solo. That's a significant departure from the past, when campers primarily arrived in pre-existing friend groups. Liam McLeod, marketing director at Camp No Counselors, describes it as camp magic, a powerful sense of connection, camaraderie, that's hard to replicate in the regular world. Schreiber herself was motivated because she felt isolated in Manhattan after college, genuinely longing for deeper friendships. The camps meticulously craft this experience to foster connection. Camp Social, for instance, in the Poconos, uses social media for outreach, strategically divides campers by age into bunks of 8-10, employs trained counselors as bonding facilitators and camp concierges. They even come up with bunk cheers to foster camaraderie. Activities blend traditional camp fun boating, archery, tie-dye with adult embellishments like paint and sip classes, mixology lessons.
The financial model, costing around $883.51 for 2 nights, 3 days, is proving profitable thanks partly to strategic brand partnerships with companies like Dunkin', LaCroix, Amazon Prime. Unlike all-inclusive vacations or wellness retreats, these camps specifically focus on fostering genuine connection through shared experiences in nature, engaging in new activities with new friends. Attendees like Maddie Martino felt lighter and more worry-free afterwards. Jamie Gulati from Camp Camp, a specialized camp for LGBTQ individuals, highlights lasting friendships, boasting a remarkable 75% return rate, and even met her girlfriend there.
It really seems to tap into a genuine human need in our increasingly digital world. For you, the listener, how do you seek out genuine human connection? What role do novel experiences play in helping you build new relationships? And do you think camp magic is something adults truly need to recapture to combat feelings of isolation?
A great question for our modern age. Here's a relatable urban dilemma that many of us who work remotely or frequent cafes might have encountered. Coffee shops banning laptops?
I was immediately hooked by the author's personal experience in this article. She describes her downtown Manhattan cafe putting up angry signs, explicitly prohibiting laptops, iPads, or similar devices, and instead encouraging reading, daydreaming, and chit-chatting. The author quite shrewdly suspects these inevitable changes are likely related to profits, you know, with freelancers nursing one lousy Americano all day and taking up valuable table space.
It's the classic urban conflict, isn't it? The article really unpacks the cafe laptop of phenomenon, often describing it as annoying behavior from the perspective of other patrons and the cafe owners. Laptop users are humorously called mood murderers, often seen draping themselves across multiple surfaces, pouncing on free seats the moment they open up, hovering awkwardly over patrons almost ready to leave. The piece also humorously details the impracticalities for the remote worker themselves. Dealing with patchy Wi-Fi, using a phone hotspot, feeling compelled to splurge on overpriced pastries just to justify their extended stay. The author shares a few particularly amusing anecdotes, like encountering a pampered Pomeranian searching its owner's bag for a compact mirror, or paying $9 for an iced latte served in what she described as a colostomy bag, followed by having to contort herself to sit on a swinging wooden plank. Despite these initial frustrations, the outcome of her local cafe's ban was surprisingly positive. Her local haunt seemed super without laptops, instead humming with lively chit-chat and inspired daydreaming. And to top it off, a barista conspiratorially revealed that other places in the neighborhood were planning similar bans.
A colostomal bag for a latte. You know, I've had some strange cafe experiences, but that one definitely takes the cake. It really sounds like these laptop bans actually improved the atmosphere for everyone else. For you, the listener, if you work remotely or frequent cafes, how do you navigate these evolving social norms? What are the trade-offs between finding a comfortable work environment and supporting local businesses, especially as they adapt to changing customer behavior and seek profitability?
A true modern urban dilemma. Let's turn now to pop culture and discuss why Julian Fellowes' The Gilded Age continues to resonate so strongly in 2025.
I'm always fascinated by how historical dramas can speak to our present moment. What is it about The Gilded Age that makes it so enduringly popular now?
Well, the compelling factor here, I think, is how the show, despite being set in a bygone era, captures profound aspects of a past time that reflect and even critique our present. Despite some critiques of the awfulness of certain lines of dialogue, the actors, particularly Carrie Coon, Morgan Spector, Cynthia Nixon, are universally praised for their captivating performances, really elevating the material. The show is particularly lauded for its fresh and groundbreaking treatment of race, depicting a vibrant, glamorous black upper middle class of entrepreneurs and intellectuals that was largely lost to history. It offers a crucial reexamination of that era. The dynamics between characters, like the snobbery of Christine Baranski's old money character versus the powerful black matriarch Elizabeth Kirkland, and the transgressive nature of an arranged marriage evolving unexpectedly into genuine love. They add incredible layers of intrigue and human complexity. The show's enduring appeal, in my view, stems from several factors. It offers a recognizable, discernible beauty and glamour that stands in stark contrast to what the article calls the freakish glamour of the Met Gala of today. It presents confident, almost comforting definitions of how men and women dress in an era of clear roles. This also implies a discipline in presentation, a tribute to the world, where effort was put into how one appeared. More profoundly, it portrays a society that, while brutal in some ways, operated with brute but recognizable rules that, in a weird way, were democratic. The underlying idea was, if you made money, were generous, enacted modesty, imitated dignity and refinement, you're in. The article draws a sharp contrast with 2025, where, as it states, now it's more just the money. No one has to bow to some phony old value system, and the money spurts in all directions, creating a themeless chaos, and tech billionaires in sweatshirts give us moral lectures from Jeffrey Epstein's plane. This suggests that the Gilded Age provides a structured, if flawed, historical mirror against which our own chaotic, money-driven, and sometimes morally ambiguous society is starkly reflected.
That's a powerful critique of our contemporary world framed through history. For you, the listener, how do historical narratives, even fictionalized ones, help us understand or critique the social and economic dynamics of our own time? And what lessons, if any, do you draw from a past era's defined social rules compared to the perceived chaos of today?
A lot to chew on there. Let's address a common perception about college students, often portrayed as overly sensitive snowflakes.
I'm glad we're tackling this. One professor decided to actively test this stereotype, taught significantly more controversial works, and even built an entire class around them, provocatively titled You Can't Think That. This was despite previous warnings about the risk involved for assigning books like The Coddling of the American Mind.
And did the experiment defy expectations? Absolutely. The students, with what the article describes as great enthusiasm, truly
embraced their newfound freedom to say what they thought and to change their minds. This wasn't some homogenous group that already agreed on everything. It was, in fact, a most diverse class in political and religious commitments. Advocates for polyandry, staunch defenders of traditional marriage, Zionists, vocal critics of Israel, all in the same room. Despite these profound differences, they genuinely learned to be good intellectual friends, carrying disagreements into the halls, even setting up lunch dates to continue discussions. The why behind this success, according to the professor, is that students live up to expectations. If they are reminded of their intellectual freedom and are confident that administrators, professors, classmates are truly committed to its exercise, they will engage with challenging ideas, not shy away. Topics debated robustly included whether the U.S. is the greatest country, whether racism is overused as an explanation for societal ills, the enduring importance of biological sex versus gender identity. The conclusion from this experiment is clear. Students are hungry as ever for intellectual freedom and deserve this education. It powerfully emphasizes challenging ideas while always respecting the person. As one student profoundly stated, people are more than their ideas.
That student quote really encapsulates the ideal. For you, the listener, how important is open debate and the ability to challenge ideas, even uncomfortable ones, for personal growth and societal progress? And based on your own observations or experiences, do you believe the educational system consistently provides this kind of intellectual freedom, or is there still work to be done?
A vital question for any thriving society. Now, let's take a critical look at media and political narratives.
Yeah.
Specifically, how Russiagate is argued to have, perhaps ironically, shaped perceptions around Donald Trump and contributed to his political trajectory.
Right. The core argument here revolves around what the article describes as the media's talking points, not inquiry approach. And that often used, seemingly benign phrase, two things can be true. This phrase, it suggests, was often used to conflate distinct issues.
What's truly insightful here is the unpacking of how media conflation and its consequences have played out in a major political narrative. The article uses illustrative examples to highlight this problematic pattern. For instance, Russia could indeed have engaged in hacking, and the Clinton campaign could simultaneously have fabricated evidence. Or Trump associates could genuinely have had suspicious ties, and the FBI could have acted improperly in its investigation. The piece points to a specific NPR segment titled, Is There Anything Left to Learn About the Russia Investigation?, where host Ari Shapiro's lazy and likely unconscious conflation of Russian influence and Trump collusion was only corrected by a guest, Renee Diresta, who precisely explained that they are distinct issues. The critique is that the media's sole approach too often became simply refuting Trump's scattershot claims as a substitute for an honest, comprehensive accounting of what actually happened. This pattern, the article argues, extends to the highly controversial Hunter Biden laptop story, described as so clearly a deliberate, premeditated scheme by many of the same people to lie about Mr. Trump and Russia. The latest revelation cited in the article, suggesting intelligence agencies doctored up a new finding after Trump's 2016 victory, claiming Russia intentionally sought his win despite earlier assessments, further complicate and muddy the narrative. The article concludes that, ironically, the media itself has become Trump-like, where facts are viewed primarily as either pro-Trump or anti-Trump, rather than simply true or false objective realities. The ultimate impact, it argues, is that the collusion fraud's exposure vindicated Mr. Trump, playing a significant, perhaps underappreciated role in his return to the White House. Voters, it suggests, found it easy to fit subsequent impeachments, criminal charges into a familiar deep state again pattern, reinforcing his narrative rather than discrediting it.
This offers a very critical perspective on how political narratives are constructed and consumed. For you, the listener, how do you critically evaluate news reporting, especially on politically charged topics where the lines between fact and narrative can blur? What is the role of the media in shaping public perception and political outcomes, and what responsibility does it hold for the narratives it constructs?
Profound questions for any engaged citizen. On a slightly lighter but still curious note from the world of international recognition, Politico reported that Donald Trump called Norway's finance minister not just to discuss trade tariffs, but also, quite notably, his bid for the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's a classic Trump anecdote. What does his comment, "It's too bad, I deserve it, but they will never give it to me," really signify here?
Well, it actually reveals a pretty consistent personal ambition. The article notes this wasn't the first time he had raised the topic of the Nobel Peace Prize in discussions with the Norwegian finance minister. It's a small detail, but these kinds of insights into world leaders' personal ambitions, their self-perceptions, their desire for external validation.
They can tell you a lot about the dynamics of power and recognition on the global stage. It highlights that even at the highest levels of diplomacy, personal desires can sometimes intertwine quite directly with official discussions and policy objectives.
It certainly offers a unique glimpse into the human side of leadership. Let's shift gears now to the world of fine dining and American classics, specifically steakhouses.
Ah, the American steakhouse.
Yeah.
It's truly an institution, isn't it? Described as a maximalist experience powered by meat and liquor, a show-stopping bacchanal, a backdrop for business dinners, power lunches, birthdays. In essence, it's the culinary embodiment of the American psyche, large, loud, and showy. They're known for their predictable canon classic cuts, the Caesar salad prepared tableside, maybe caramelized bananas for dessert.
That's a perfect description of the quintessential American steakhouse. But the article suggests they're evolving. How are they getting weirder and more wide-ranging in their inspiration while maintaining that core appeal?
It's quite fascinating. We're seeing a significant evolution. Interestingly, even renowned chef Daniel Hum's 11 Madison Park, which famously went vegan, is returning to serving meat, partially for financial reasons, and will undoubtedly feature steak. New York City alone, in just the past year, has seen openings like La Tête d'Or from Michelin star French chef Daniel Boulud. It takes classic steakhouse elements and gallicizes them, offering a $130 Wagyu ribeye with elegant tableside grating of truffles. Then there's Cuerno, a Mexican steakhouse featuring a roving taquero making delicious bone marrow and strip steak tacos tableside, infusing the traditional with vibrant Latin flavors. And Goldenhof, a Korean steakhouse, brings the interactive experience of table grilling directly to its patrons. Steakhouses are truly internationalizing their offerings. Kwama Onwuachi is opening Maroon, a Caribbean steakhouse in Las Vegas, featuring Nigerian suya skewers, jerk seasoning. Alfred Portale's Sartiano's will offer an Italianate steakhouse experience. The focus is increasingly on creating unique, spend-worthy experiences beyond just a great piece of meat. Miami's Sunny Someday Steakhouse, started as a pop-up, now serves martinis in ice-filled vessels flanked by elegant silver elephants, adding theatricality. And Orlando's Knife & Spoon offers a cheesecake Mont Blanc with a Wonka-esque chocolate extruder for tableside garnishing, transforming dessert into a spectacle.
That's a brilliant way to keep a classic relevant. For you, the listener, how do traditional industries, like fine dining, adapt and innovate to stay relevant and exciting in a changing economy and culture? It shows that even a classic can evolve without losing its essence if it's willing to get a little weird.
Precisely. Now for a practical style tip, especially for men, the third piece rule.
This simple strategy involves adding a third garment or accessory to your basic pants and shirt or t-shirt. The purpose, according to stylists, is to add pizzazz and effortlessly pull the entire look together, making it appear more polished and intentional.
It's a concept that sounds simple but makes a profound difference. Many guys, as the article points out, focus only on their shirt and pants, overlooking the seemingly small but crucial oversight. The third piece rule is an old-school fashion strategy that helps explain why models and campaigns for brands like Buck Mason or Mr. Porter always look so effortlessly stylish. It's that added layer. To make it work effectively, you start with a blank canvas, a relatively plain top and pants, consciously avoiding loud logos, busy prints, or overly oversized cuts that detract. For your color palette, the advice is incorporate one light tone, one mid-tone, and one dark tone, or use contrasting colors and textures to add visual interest. To reliably add that visual interest, choose something textured. A ribbed sweater, a durable cotton twill short coat, a lightweight windbreaker with a faint sheen. The journal provided some excellent specific examples. Base of beige tee and faded jeans. Add a dark cotton bomber jacket for a modern touch, or a chocolate lightweight sweater draped casually over the shoulders for sophisticated nonchalance. For accessories, a Western belt with subtle suede and decorative stitching worn with a tucked-in tee adds character. Or even a bold sculptural pendant necklace for contemporary flair.
It's amazing how such a small strategic addition can elevate an entire outfit. For you, the listener, how can small strategic additions to your wardrobe impact your personal presentation and confidence? And are there similar rules or principles you apply in other areas of your life beyond fashion to elevate a basic foundation or add that extra polish?
A good question about subtle enhancements. Now, for a surprising trend in women's fashion that's making waves, toddler-style clothes for chic women.
Yes, this kidcore aesthetic, as it's being called, embraces elements like oversized sailor collars, sparkly jelly sandals, even plush bunny evening bags. The author, a 48-year-old mom with a hectic job, embraced this trend, explicitly looking for fun and a sense of lightheartedness in her wardrobe.
What's truly fascinating here are the origins and the broader implications of this playful reversal in fashion.
Recent cultural influences have undoubtedly fueled this. Greta Gerwig's Barbie movie unleashed a torrent of pink, candy-colored accessories, a desire for playful femininity. There's the mania for bag charms like Labudu, the appearance of whimsical Simone Roche's faux fur rabbits on high-fashion runways. The author herself fell completely for it, recalling her own 80s girlhood jelly shoes, noting how Loeffler Randall's champagne glitter jellies sold out incredibly fast, indicating a broad appeal for this nostalgic comfort. Jesse Randall, co-founder of Loeffler Randall, theorizes people are essentially themselves when they're in kindergarten and are, perhaps unconsciously, trying to get back to that awesome person through their clothing choices. Fashion historian Ruby Redstone sees this as a really interesting reversal, particularly because historically, kids' clothes were either miniature adult styles or entirely distinct. She suggests it's a direct reaction to a world in turmoil, a collective obsession with nostalgia and that feeling of lost childhood, seeking comfort and innocence. The author's personal trials trying these looks provided some truly humorous reactions. Her husband thought she was dating Minnie Mouse, wearing a polka dot maxi skirt and cherry red Coach star purse. A co-worker remarked her leafy green sheath with a candy bracelet swatch and salmon pink jelly sandals were giving Ms. Frizzle from the Magic School Bus. A neighbor called her crimson sailor topper, her dream outfit from fifth grade. At a cocktail party, her Simone Rocha faux fur hair bag elicited gasps, comments like fresh carcass or a purse, taxidermy chic, with one person humorously saying she was manhandling that cat. Despite some awkward moments, surprised reactions, the author concluded, "I can't remember the last time I had so much fun."
That's such a great illustration of how fashion can be an escape. For you, the listener, how do cultural anxieties and a desire for escapism manifest in fashion trends? And what role does nostalgia play in your own choices? Clothing, entertainment, lifestyle, do you find yourself drawn to the comforts of the past?
A really interesting cultural barometer. In a related fashion trend, we're seeing a direct counterpoint to quiet luxury emerge, what's being dubbed rich Italian wives fashion.
Yes, this is a distinct shift, with shoppers apparently eschewing quiet luxury's subdued neutrals for bold, maximalist styles that truly make a statement.
This is a clear vibe shift that's all over social media, prominent on American and European beaches this summer. Dominant brands embodying this look are quintessential Italian legacy houses. Pucci's vibrant geometric patterns, Missoni's iconic zigzags, Roberto Cavalli's daring animal prints. Fashion trend forecaster Zoe Stewart calls it the antithesis of Mary-Kate and Ashley Kore, aspiring instead to the aspirational rich Italian wife look immortalized by photographer Slim Ahrens. Think Saint-Tropez, cigarettes, a confident, flirtatious attitude. Sales data unequivocally supports this. Missoni and Pucci sales doubled at Metherisa. Luxury sourcer Gab Waller reports demand for vintage Cavalli now bypassing quiet luxury brands like Loro Piana, Prada. Serena Morris, a content creator embodying this style, raves, "Pucci's a palate cleanser that wipes away any negativity in your life. You wear it and it's like, life is good, pass me an Aperol Spritz." Oh, the secondhand market is booming too. Vintage Cavalli dresses up 191% on the RealReal. Missoni searches up 91% on Depop, offering luxury items at a fraction of retail, making the look more accessible. Vestiaire Collective saw Missoni Pucci sales up 31%, 51% in the first half of 2025. Silk scarves popular, encapsulating a jet-set way of living, Dolce Vita vibes. Personal experiences reinforce this trend's pervasiveness. Tamar Subali wears Pucci Missoni to combat travel FOMO during her pregnant summer, feeling like she's on vacation even when not. Charlene Hadim felt like the biggest idiot in Cannes because every single girl was in Missoni, highlighting how quickly this trend became ubiquitous among a certain set. Surya Garg felt extremely confident, possibly too confident, in vintage Cavalli pants, suggesting the power of the look to transform self-perception. However, Stewart, the trend forecaster, offers a critique, wondering if it's just to take a cute picture for TikTok, expecting many items resold by October, suggesting it might be a fleeting social media phenomenon rather than a deep cultural shift.
That's a fascinating insight into the ephemeral nature of some social media-driven trends. For you, the listener, how does social media influence fashion trends? And do you perceive these trends as genuine cultural shifts reflecting broader societal sentiments, or more as fleeting performances driven by viral moments, the desire for aspirational imagery?
A great question for our highly visual world. Now, let's turn to a classic summer destination, Martha's Vineyard.
Martha's Vineyard has truly transformed over the decades. From quiet fishing villages, a bohemian haven, it's become a playground for the rich and famous. Especially after Jaws in 75, the Clintons' high-profile visit in 93, prices skyrocketed. The author of this article posed a crucial question many might ask. Does the island still offer space for quiet contemplation and artistic inspiration? Can you enjoy it without a trust fund?
That's the million-dollar question for many aspiring visitors. And A. Boudoin van Riper, a research librarian at the Martha's Vineyard Museum, offers an encouraging answer. That still, to a surprising degree, exists if you know where to look for it. Okay. The author's own experience started with significant sticker shock. $1,500 for two nights at a hotel, $1,309 for an Airbnb cottage. Yikes. But they diligently found an affordable option at Martha's Vineyard Family Campground. Cabins were $229 a night, but pitching a tent cost about a third of that. They opted for carless travel, a key to more affordable exploration. Flew direct, rented a sturdy bike for $120, navigated the eastern end with its extensive bike paths. For further travel, they discovered the surprisingly efficient buses, free through September, reaching up-island destinations like West Tisbury, Chilmark. Fred Riper's advice to get out of the downtowns proved invaluable for finding that quieter, more authentic experience. A memorable meal for the author, a delicious salmon banh mi enjoyed slowly on the porch of the Chilmark General Store, where lingering was significantly encouraged. The island actually offers extensive gratis offerings.
16 miles of public beach, 40 square miles of protected forest wetland, 15 ponds, 40 miles of bike trails. Natural beauty is quite accessible. Julie Vanderhoop, a Wampanoag elder and local bakery owner, observed that while it's hard to figure out what people are really here for sometimes, the island could actually give someone respite if they seek it.
It sounds like the essence of the island is still there, if you know how to find it. For you, the listener, how do you find value and authentic experiences in destinations associated with luxury or exclusivity? What does escape truly mean to you, and how do you prioritize experiences over extravagance when planning getaways? It's about finding that personal connection beyond the price tag.
An important distinction to make. Here's a surprising home maintenance and safety issue many of us might overlook. It hit me when I read it. Foundation plantings.
Yes, the premise is quite startling. The leafy green borders you think flatter your house are wrecking it. This issue gained prominence in Northern California with Ordinance #1309, urging homeowners to clear a 5-foot zone around houses specifically for wildfire prevention.
What's truly fascinating here is how this local ordinance highlighted a universal, often overlooked problem. Beyond just fire zones, these seemingly innocuous plantings cause moisture damage, mildew, blocked vents, termites, tunneling roots, directly against your home's foundation. The wildfire connection is particularly critical. It's not the live plants themselves that ignite first, but the accumulated flammable leaf litter they drop and trap at the base of your house. The author had a powerful realization. Basically, I've been stockpiling kindling around my house for years. This hedge against the house style, common for decades, actually originated in the 1840s from landscape architects like Andrew Jackson Downing, but it was never intended to shrub up the entire base of a building in the dense way we often see today. The article offers practical solutions beyond creating a stark, unappealing lunar landing site look. Alternatives include durable hardscape, brick, crushed brick, bluestone, river rock, mixed materials, colors, textures, like charming Italian piazzas, sculptural elements, decorative rocks, a small path with a bird bath, carefully chosen outdoor art, can create visual interest within that critical 5-foot zone. Beyond 5 feet lawn or planting beds with visual drama, like vibrant red foxglove or crocosmia, strategically placed Japanese maple trees draw the eye up and away from the foundation. Arborists are noticing a significant shift in homeowner awareness. Younger homeowners asking more questions about fire safety, smart landscaping. The author herself, after much soul searching, bravely let her hedges go, replaced them with stepping stones, low, fire-resistant plants. Her house now looks grounded, eyes drawn elsewhere. And she concludes, quite memorably, she sleeps better knowing my yard is less likely to go up like a tiki torch.
That's a surprisingly practical and impactful lesson from something you'd never think about. For you, the listener, what hidden dangers or maintenance issues in your own home or daily life might be overlooked because of long-standing habits or simple aesthetic preferences? It's a great reminder to question what we've always done and consider the underlying function.
Indeed. Now let's take a moment to reflect on two remarkable lives, as remembered in their obituaries this week. First, Dodi Osteen, co-founder of Lakewood Church, one of the nation's largest.
Her story is truly one of incredible faith and perseverance. Diagnosed with metastatic liver cancer in 1981, given mere weeks to live, she famously refused chemotherapy, believed in miracles, was cancer-free within 2 years. She spent the rest of her life telling her story to inspire hope, emphasizing God's power to heal. However, the article also mentions some criticism of false promises, sometimes associated with prosperity gospel leaders. Her son, Joel Osteen, later took over, grew the church tremendously into the global phenomenon it is today.
Her legacy is deeply intertwined with faith, the power of personal testimony, touching millions through her story, the monumental growth of Lakewood under her family's leadership. Then we have Morton Meyerson, a computer outsourcing pioneer, instrumental in building Ross Perot's EDS into a powerhouse. His journey began by chance. A bridge game in 61 led to an Army computer course. He discovered an innate knack for efficiency, solving complex problems with tech. Joined Perot's EDS in 66, quickly became its principal builder and leader, president by 79. Famously oversaw Medicare Medicaid claims processing, a massive profit source for EDS. Instrumental in persuading major corporations to outsource IT, a revolutionary concept then. Meyerson was also a significant advisor, mentor to many, advised Perot's 92 presidential campaign, mentored figures like Michael Dell, Mark Cuban, even encouraged Cuban with Broadcast.com. What's particularly compelling is how his leadership style evolved. Initially at EDS, he pushed demanding 80-hour weeks, death marches to meet deadlines. But later at Perot Systems, he developed a softer touch, encouraged family time volunteering, famously canceled a $360 Christmas party to instead buy goods for the poor, help distribute them.
That's a fascinating evolution in leadership style. For you, the listener, what can we learn about leadership, change, legacy from individuals who impacted their fields in such different ways? One through spiritual inspiration, the other through technological and business innovation. Both demonstrated immense influence, but through vastly different approaches.
Indeed. Now let's do a quick dive into the literary world with our curated bookshelf, exploring some new and reissued titles that caught the journal's eye.
First up is The Golden Thread, first of two volumes on Western civilization. Covers Marathon to the Italian Renaissance. Aims to show how fundamental Western assumptions, equality, dignity, are traceable to specific historical moments.
Then Ring of Fire delves into WWI beyond the familiar trenches, explores impact on neutral nations, atrocities by all sides, civilian terror, gives voice to sidelined groups, Danish draftees for Germany, Poles under other flags, colonial troops, highlights German illegal submarine warfare, British illegal blockade causing food shortages in Latin America. No belligerents had clean hands. Next, a compelling reissued classic. Tolstoy's long-neglected Resurrection, written after his spiritual crisis, follows a wealthy protagonist's moral regeneration, confronting ruling class cruelty, journeying towards redemption, timely fiction, Jason Green's Unworld, Your AI Wants a Divorce, Near Future AI Uploads Assist People, One Seeks Emancipation After a Son's Death, explores grief, identity, connection, suggests once alienating tech becomes banal, even comfy, surveillance as acknowledgement. Also Threads of Empire and Carpe Diem, exploring history, aesthetics of hand-woven rugs, symbolism of wealth, power, like the artable carpet. Contrasts scholar Armstrong versus aesthete Bradley, whose memoir recounts being seduced by beautiful rugs, noting color is to an antique rug what bouquet is to a vintage wine. Then Will Eisner, the spirited life of a comics pioneer, graphic novel biography celebrating Eisner's influence, his role as artistic conscience. Covers early work, Sheena, production line approach, the spirit. Missing the Marvel boom, key work. A Contract with God, 1978, deeply personal, expressed anguish after daughter's death, paved way for modern graphic novel. Also Bogart and Houston, When the Stars Aligned, detailing the formidable partnership, Maltese Falcon, Sierra Madre, Key Largo, African Queen. Relationship peculiar to Hollywood, existing primarily during filming, deep creative sync. Exception, UAC investigations caused estrangement, then reconciliation. For younger readers, Smoke and Mirrors, middle grade mystery. 12-year-old black narrator Andy, wrongly blamed for barn fire, investigates old murder to clear magician's name, themes of injustice, and Snoop, stuck at home, learning to spy, another middle-grade novel. 12-year-old Carter, broken leg, hacks town surveillance cameras to spy on Crush, then notices little dramas and mysteries of daily life.
That's an incredible journey through history, art, human experience. Profound ethical dilemmas to everyday wonders discovered through a new lens. For you, our listener, which of these books sparks your curiosity to explore further? What themes resonate most from this literary journey? What does it tell you about the stories we're eager to consume in 2025?
A truly diverse collection reflecting human creativity. To wrap up our cultural segment, let's talk about an engaging personality, actor and comedian Tony Hale.
He's a wonderful performer. He's openly shared how his childhood experience, bullied, dealing with anxiety, fear actually helped him nail his iconic roles. Gary Walsh in Veep, Buster Bluth in Arrested Development, the beloved existential Forky in Toy Story 4.
What's genuinely fascinating here is Hale's philosophy on past experiences. He chooses not to dwell on resentment, believing there's simply no positive outcome to it. His new movie, Sketch Kids Drawings Come to Life, touches on grief, family, well-received. He's also a proud girl dad, loves going to Beyonce, Olivia Rodrigo concerts with his daughter. Now, an empty nester, he describes it as an identity shift, a surrender, a new phase. Hobbies, making rope bowls, finds it a meditative practice. Centering. Asked about Gary Walsh in the White House, Hale mused his character would be great at a crisis, navigating tension, anticipating needs. Loves kids' movies for their simplicity. Deep, but not too deep, dealing with profound themes like grief beautifully, accessibly. His advice for younger folks in business is particularly insightful, grounding. The value you have now is the exact same value you have after whatever success you hit. If you can remember that and ground yourself in that, everything else just unfolds.
That's powerful advice, focusing on inherent worth, not external achievement. For you, the listener, how do our past experiences, even challenging ones, shape our future successes perspectives? And what does grounding yourself and your true value mean to you, especially in a world often measuring worth by external achievements, public perception? So what does this all mean after such an expansive journey? We've truly undertaken an incredible deep dive today, covered an astonishing breadth of knowledge, insight from the Wall Street Journal, from global power shifts, Europe's economic emergencies, intricacies of international diplomacy, to the shifting sands of the American economy and society, exciting frontiers of innovation, industry, even the nuanced, deeply human experiences of culture, lifestyle, personal growth. It truly underscores the immense value of taking a deep dive into diverse, high-quality sources to become truly well-informed, to understand the interconnectedness of our world.
And to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Considering the rapid shifts in technology, geopolitics, society we've discussed, from AI coding itself to the struggle for global economic leadership, changing social dynamics, how might the headlines of August 16, 2035 reflect the seeds planted in today's news? What will be the next major shift, the defining trend that is perhaps already subtly forming in the background of our lives, hidden in plain sight, waiting to burst forth a decade from now?
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it sparked your curiosity and encouraged your critical thinking. Until next time.